Okay, thank you. So lunchtime is approaching, so I'm going to try to be brief. My speech is going to be based on a paper written with Corinne Perraudin and Héloïse Petit, both from the Centre d'études de l'emploi. And this paper should be published in a special issue on corporate governance of the Louvain Economic Review, coordinated by Jackie Kraft. And also I will introduce some elements taken that refer to an article written with an extensive British team, co-authored with Neil Conway, Sue Kunzelman, Simon Deakin, and Frank Wilkinson. So the question I'd like to raise during this speech, and that runs throughout those papers, is the following: does corporate governance or corporate ownership matter for employment? Well, there are many ways to deal with such issue. For example, you can have theoretical considerations, either macro or micro, on the relationship between finance and labor. How you can have empirical analysis, case studies, or statistical analysis. And here we develop an empirical approach that uses microdata on French business establishments, French business enterprises. I think the French case is quite interesting because, as Thomas just told us, more on the German case, but there has been deep transformation of the French corporate governance system over the last decade, over the last two decades. So let me start with some very basic facts on the French corporate governance model. So here, on this figure, you can see the evolution of stock market capitalization as a percentage of gross domestic product in three countries: France, the UK, and Germany. And this is a rather good proxy for stock market activity or stock market importance in a given country, in a given jurisdiction. So if we start to observe at the beginning of the 90s, it's quite easy. We identify the classical distinction between an outsider model of corporate governance with very little, the case of UK, with a stock market capitalization that represents almost 100% of GDP. And then you have France and Germany with rather low stock market capitalization. But then, so rather an insider model of corporate governance. But then look at the end of the 90s, we see that France starts to grow away, and so that now, as compared to Germany, so that now in the mid 2000s, France is approaching the UK with a stock market capitalization representing more than 100% of GDP. And the interesting point is if we try to understand the main factor between this upswing of stock market importance in France. Clearly, it's not the case that we have more listed companies. In France, the number of listed companies tend to decrease since the 90s, the second part of the 90s. So this upswing is mainly due to the increasing activity on French stock market of institutional investors, excluding banks, so mutual funds and, as I'm going to argue, pension funds. So we have first resident funds. So those resident funds are mainly mutual funds. We call them SICAV in France. Today, the resident institutional investors, mutual funds, own about a quarter of the French outstanding shares for listed companies. But the main factor behind this upswing is probably the increasing activity of non-resident investors, and in particular, North American funds, mutual funds, and pension funds. Here, you have a clear indication of this movement. So, The blue line indicates the percentage of equity capital held by non-residents for French-listed companies, and the orange line is for non-listed companies. And we see that, so we see a clear increase, and in 2003, more than 30% of French listed company shares are owned by non-residents, around 20% by Anglo-Saxon institutional investors. So now we can say that institutional investors, both resident and non-resident, are clearly today collectively the main owner of French listed companies, just like in the UK or in the US. So we have this rather to power of institutional investors, and at the same time we have observed deep changes in financial market law and to a lesser extent in corporate law, pointing toward the greater protection for minority shareholders. And well, to sum up this those changes, we can say that there is now a clear increasing sensitivity of French managers to the interest of minority shareholders and stock market valuation. In the paper, in both papers, we discuss some related facts in terms of dividends, share buybacks, use of stock option to incentivize executive. So, but here, I would like to ask a question: what are the likely consequences of this movement on labor? So I would like to discuss some relations between corporate governance on one side and human resource management practices, HRM, on the other side. A first argument might be found in the variety of capitalism approach, as developed by Alan Susskind 2001, and this approach stresses the macroeconomic complementarities between, in a given jurisdiction, in a given country, between the stock market and the labor market, with the idea that active stock market, liquid stock market, tends to, well, an active stock market does not favor mutual commitments between the firm and workers, so that it should decrease job tenure and training. Those hypotheses have been tested on a cross-sectional basis by Black, Gospel and Pendleton for OECD country, and they find a negative relationship between the activity of stock market and job tenure, but no relationship between stock market activity and training. So this approach is obviously very interesting, but a problem is that it's not possible, by definition, to discriminate between firms according to whether or not they are listed, according to whether or not their equity capital is held by financial investors. At the opposite, we have some very interesting qualitative monographs, case studies, that try to track changes in human resource management for listed companies. We have a good example in the British case with a study by Deakin, Ops, Konzelman and Wilkinson, 2006, and a very interesting one made by Jackson, Oepner and Kohl de Busch, 2005, on the German case. I'm going to comment later on the precise finding of this study, but for now, I think the main result of those studies is to indicate that a shareholder value-oriented way to manage a business is associated with a particular profile of human resource management practices. But obviously, these are monographs, and so we lack, I would say, statistical evidence of the impact of stock market on human resource management. So what we try to do here is to observe differences or differentiation of human resource management practices between firms according to whether or not the company is listed and according to whether or not the equity capital is mainly held by financial investors resident or non-resident. To do so, we can start with the following proposition that we discussed more precisely in the paper, which is quite, I would say, regulationist in flavor. Well, we can say that in a capitalist system, every company has to achieve, over the medium-long run, a level of financial returns at least equal to the cost of capital. But beyond this level, there's a margin, and this margin depends on the macro-institutional, macroeconomic context. So it might explain why, if we consider this figure, we have the level of financial for listed companies in France, the US, Germany, and United Kingdom. And this is a work made by Delavaux and Duterte. And very briefly, what we see here is that ROE, the return on equity, is always higher in the US and in the UK as compared to France and Germany. But it's not related to the productive efficiency or productivity. It's probably the fact that the macro-institutional context is more shareholder value oriented. So, if true, the increasing role played by the stock market in corporate governance strengthens the requirement for financial returns. And I think that a good illustration of this proposition is might be found in the EVA, the economic value added, which is the most widespread classical way to measure shareholder value. So here you see that in a given year for a given company, EVA, so the value created for shareholder, is equal, so EC, it's the book value of equity capital, times the difference between ROE, the financial return, and K, which is the cost of capital. So simply put, you create value for your shareholder, you increase EVA if you maximize the return on equity above a benchmark, and this benchmark is the cost of capital. So now a useful way to proceed is to consider the likely consequence of this these financial requirements and human resource management. So a first proposition we make in both papers is to say that human resource management might be used to maximize net results, the profit, and so the return on equity. But once we say that, we can see that there is two clear opposite strategies to maximize net results. Either you can try to minimize costs, or you can try to maximize total income. So let's start with the first strategy that we term a low road strategy or defensive strategy. And if you consider the literature regarding the effect of stock market pressure on HRM, clearly this low road strategy is a basic way to consider the, and find a good example of this, good description of this strategy in Newton 1995 or Porter 1997. So here's the idea is that short-term financial requirements result in a cost-cutting approach to human resource management. Why? Because labor costs are the main component of total costs, so they offer the most direct leverage to increase profits. So if this Loro hypothesis is true, then we should find negative relationship between stock market activity, stock market pressure, and training, wages, and so on. Now there is a second hypothesis, which we term here hybrid hypothesis, where investments in human capital through high wages, through training expenditures, are used to increase total income over the long run, and so to maximize the return on equity. So the basic point I'd like to make here is that, considering the literature, there is no clear relationship between shareholder value approach to managing a business and wages and training. There's there's a second effect of a second way to understand the effect of stock market on HRM. If we consider that HRM might be used to control the variations of ROE. Why to control the variation of ROE? Well, what is the interest here? Well, for a listed company, a destruction of shareholder value, so here it means a positive return on equity but below the cost of capital, runs the risk of provoking a fall in the share of price. So we argue in the paper that the prominent effect of stock market pressure is to strengthen the damaging consequence in case of poor short-term profits. Here, maybe the idea is that the sanction by stock market is probably quicker than the sanction coming from product market. So, if true, listed companies might seek a greater flexibility for their costs, and in particular for labor costs. So, how to obtain this flexibility? There are basically it's two ways. So, it's basic labor economics. So first, you can have a flexibility of employment, so you can use flexible forms of employment, either employment contracts or either through commercial contracts. These are temporary agency workers and subcontracting. But also you can have flexibility of the wage bill through the use of flexible pay practices, and basically these are individual or collective bonus schemes, which are reversible, so they enable to have flexibility in the wage bill. So now, if I try to sum up this discussion, the idea here is that stock market listing and the penetration of financial funds in equity capital might influence human resource management at three different levels. First, it might increase the needs for flexibility. Second, it may have impact on the level of wage. And third, it might have impact on training expenditures. Now I'm going to describe very quickly the empirical analysis. Well, we use a French database that merges together two different sources. The first one is a representative survey on human resource management and industrial relations called the Survey Réponse. And the first one dates from 1992, then the second one in 1998, and the third one is Réponse 2004. And so this is a very rich survey with a lot of information on the establishment. Well, we have information on the structure of equity capital, but a lot of information on human resource management and so on. And so we merge this survey with an administrative source that provides information on wages in the establishment. So here, on this table, you have the information we use to observe the structure of equity ownership. So we have a sample of 2,521 establishments. 993 belongs to listed companies, and among them we have 144 establishments that belongs to listed companies with resident funds at the main category of owners, and approximately the same quantity with non-resident funds, nationality, with non-resident funds at the main category of owners. And so we have 1,528 establishments belonging to non-listed companies. So the basic principle of the empirical analysis is to assess the influence of listing and of the identity of main shareholders on a broad range of human resource management practices. All the technical aspects, methodological, the specification of the models, the robustness check, and so on, are presented on the paper, so I'm not going to present that. And just an important point. We use an extensive set of controls in the regressions, and we have access to this extensive set of controls thanks to the response survey, because there is a lot of information in it. So we control for establishment characteristics, sector, the size, number of employees, total income, establishment age. We also control for the competitive environment, market share, predictability of demand, the state of the market, either growing, declining. And we finally control for characteristic of the workforce. This is very important if we try to explain wages, obviously, because we know, for example, with human capital theory, very dependent of individual characteristic of the workforce. So we control here for the structure of occupational groups, percentage of managerial workers, technicians, frontline workers, and so on, the proportion of employees aged under 40, and the proportion of women. Very quickly, I propose to make a bit linear presentation of the main findings as they appear in the analysis, and then I'm going to have a more synthetic conclusion to have a global picture of what's going on here. So in this table, each line corresponds to a different human resource management practices, and then I indicate the coefficient, the estimation of the parameters for establishment belonging to listed companies rather than non-listed company. So concerning the identity of owners, whether resident or non-resident, financial investors are the main owner, in the regression we introduce cross effects. I'm not going to comment the result except when they are very significant. So here what we see, basically, let's start with just the first line as an example. We see that, other things being equal, belonging to a listed company significantly increases the probability to have an intensive use of agency workers. It also significantly increases the use of subcontracting, and it tends to decrease, very significantly, the use of fixed-term employment contracts. And also, last effect, being listed has no effect on the probability to have a decrease in workforce over the last 3 years, but it tends to decrease the probability to have an increase in workforce size. I'm going to go back on this result later on, sorry. So, the first comment I want to make here is that we observe a strong tendency to refer to agency workers or subcontractors among listed companies, but a weak use of fixed-term labor contracts. Now, second empirical findings relating to pay practices, we have information on the use of individual or collective bonuses for managerial and non-managerial workers. And clearly what we see here is that being listed distinctly increases the probability of using individual and collective bonus schemes, for all types of employees, especially when non-resident financial firms are the main owners. The cross effect of being listed with foreign funds in the equity capital is very strong. Now, the third empirical findings concerning wages and training. So we have information on the level of the mean wage in the establishment, also the median wage, and we have information on training expenditure at the percentage of the wage bill. And here, we see that wage levels, both average and median, are higher in listed companies, as well as levels of training expenditures and the effect of foreign fund and resident fund is quite significant here as well. So the conclusion here would be that wages and training do not follow a rationale of cost minimization within listed companies. So I'd like to make some conclusion on financialization. First, there's a clear evidence here that ownership matters for human resource management practices and working conditions. And the reason is that ownership or corporate governance contributes to shape the final objective of the company. And human resource management is a crucial leverage, a crucial tool to meet those objectives. And more precisely, we identify a particular profile of human resource management associated with stock market listing and the penetration of equity capital by financial firms. And this profile is characterized by three main features. The first feature is flexibility. Stock market listing is associated with a strong search for cost flexibility, either through the use of bonus schemes or through the use of commercial contracts, temporary agency workers or subcontracting, but not through employment contracts. We find a negative relationship between stock market and fixed-term contracts. Now, the second feature of this particular HRM profile is a limited core group management style, which means that listed companies tend to maintain the workforce around a relatively limited core group of employees. Evidence of this strategy are to be found in the negative effect of listing on the use of employment fixed-term contracts, as well as in the reluctance to hire over the last 3 years. I remind you that we find a negative impact of stock market on the probability to have an increase in the workforce size over the last 3 years. And now, last feature, what we have called the high-road strategy. Listed companies adopt an offensive high-road strategy for human resource management, but this commitment to human resources is concentrated on a relatively limited number of long-term employees. So, finally, we have here a picture that indicates a dual strategy adopted by listed companies to cope with financial requirements. Dual strategy is characterized by enhancement of human capital on one side, the high-road strategy, but cost minimization through subcontracting on the other side. So it means that part of the profitability of listed companies is obtained through subcontracting. And so if true, it means that the influence of financialization goes well beyond listed companies to shape the whole productive sectors, in particular through the subcontracting story. Now, the second set of conclusions I'd like to make concern more the comparative aspect of this work. First, our findings are quite coherent, are in line with the conclusions reached by Jackson Huebner and Kulderbusch on the German case. So they have done monographs on what they call shareholder-friendly companies. So they identify shareholder-friendly companies through a broad set of indicators, for example, the use of stock option, whether they communicate a lot with their shareholders, whether they communicate on EVA, economic value added, and so on. And what they have found is that those companies tend to fall back on a stable core of employees. This is approximately what we find as well. Listed shareholder-friendly companies also tend to increase the level of mean wage for this core of employees. And last but not least, they found a generalization of the use of bonus schemes in listed companies. Now, if we consider the British case, well, it's very different. For the British case, with Neil Conway, Deakin Conzelman, and Frank Wilkinson, we had the opportunity to work on two very similar data sets, the Réponse survey in the French case and the WIRS survey in the British case. The WIRS survey is a workplace employment relations survey. And both surveys are very close, in fact. And so we test basically some of the hypotheses I just presented. And here we find no evidence of the hierodact approach to human resource management in listed companies. And just to finish, what are the plausible explanations for this difference between continental Europe on one side, Germany and France, and the British case on the other side? Well, I would say that labor law is a natural candidate. We know that workers' rights are much more important in France and in Germany as compared to the UK. This is clear for involvement rights in corporate governance, information and consultation rights, but obviously in the German case, co-determination rights. But it is also the case for all the rights that on the protection for industrial actions, for example, in case of strike, which are very important in France. And so what we try to argue in the paper with Simon Deakin is that those rights tend to increase the bargaining position of worker representatives, and that this increased bargaining position has some influence on the way listed companies cope with requirements. It has influence on the way financial requirements are delivered. And here, this idea is very close from a position made by Wolfgang Streck a few years ago, and discussed in a recent issue of the Socioeconomic Review, where he exposed the idea of beneficial constraints. This is the idea that workers' rights are first perceived by corporate executives as constraints, but those constraints have unexpected effects, and in particular, they may favor cooperation, commitment in the establishment, in firms, with some positive effect on efficiency. So maybe what the difference between France and Germany and British case might be interpreted as evidence of this beneficial constraint hypothesis. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well,